The workers must work, so we've moved inside because of the
lawnmower.
And you were talking about the border issues, but we haven't really officially introduced the border issues project. So if you'd like to say a few minutes or a few things about that, and then we'll go back to misconceptions that at least one person on the U.S. side of the picture had about the ins and outs of the Canadian Grain Commission.
The thing I found interesting in the exercise, Nancy, and I'm just using this as an offside, but the perspective that most people have in the world of the Canadian grain system, there are a few that completely understand how Canada works, understand the Canada Grains Commission and the value of it, understand the Canadian Wheat Board and what it did and how it did things. But all too often, it's not too dissimilar to, as I suggested, the arguments from producers around issues within their own grain industry. Not a great deal of accurate information to base some of the positions that they took on them. Canadian Wheat Board and the American system in particular, they didn't pretend they understood it, they didn't want to understand it, and they just knew how it worked. And they were dead wrong. So in discussions with Tony Flagg, as an example.
And how is that last name spelled?
F-L-A-G-G.
Okay.
He didn't like the Canadian Wheat Board, and we finally got...
Are the Wheat Board or the Grain Commission?
No, this is the Wheat Board.
Okay.
As an example. And he said, well, it costs me too much to buy grain. And we said, Tony, why do you buy grain for your mill? Like he said, I get 11 cars in. He said, I tried to deal with producers, and you get producer cars in. He said, on the unload, I would have 11 different kinds of wheat. And he said, I had no idea how the mill would work and what they would do with some of this stuff. We said, yeah, this is right. Guess what? Because of our system, provides a homogeneous product right across the prairies, and you generally, from the Canada Grains Commission perspective, when you get a grade and you know what the falling numbers are, etc., you know that there's 11 cars of grain will unload and perform the same all the way through. Producers can't do that. But the Canadian Wheat Board, for example, can assemble that because they know where everything's at with the Canada Grains Commission and sell you a product. But they charge too much. That was his only argument. We said, in other words, you can buy cheaper from the Canadian farmer, and the Canadian Wheat Board is doing what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to be getting maximum value for a product for the producer, and we share those profits later on, final payments or whatever. Well, he guessed so, but it wasn't in his interest as a miller. But he did like the product that came out of Canada because we could guarantee a product, certificate final from the Canada Grains Commission, and it arrived and it performed as he said. So it was interesting to hear that discussion, and that was sort of how things used to go. People's perception of things, it was either costing them too much money, or they didn't need that kind of a product, or they didn't want to pay for that kind of a product at least. But they would grudgingly admit that the Canadian system could provide them with something that no other... We said to Tony, why don't you buy your grain local? Americans produce wheat. He knew that, but he said, I can't buy the quality that Canada's got and get the guarantee. And they have a system. So it was an interesting conversation in an evening. It didn't happen. It was just a little bug that needed... Got to look after the little folk, too. Anyway, that's sort of an offside, but it is an example of how the world perceives Canada all too often. And we've learned to take some of the things that our regulatory system has provided for us for granted, and sometimes don't even ourselves understand what it has done for us in the long term. And I worry a little bit, Nancy, as I watch the events unfold now with our regulatory system. And I almost speak with a forked tongue when I do this. I mean, this facility we're sitting in right now, regulations have forced us to do what we've done with food services. and I abhor regulations. I would rather ask for forgiveness than permission. I'm probably as free enterprise as any other person, and that was a perception too. If you're a co-op person, you're definitely a socialist. Pretty near every farmer I met, every person that sat at a corporate board table for a cooperative, and I use that term loosely, the corporate part, they were all free enterprisers. They weren't necessarily socialists, but I called them, they were free enterprisers with a conscience, is how I term a cooperator.
And how would you describe that conscience?
Integrity. And they have a social conscience. They believe that people working together can accomplish a lot more than individualism. True free enterprise, and I'm not giving out political stripes here because I'm apolitical. In Alberta, it was difficult to be a cooperator because we were socialists. No question as far as the Conservative government looked at. In fact, some of the, I remember an individual in Winnipeg standing up and talking about us Pinkos. And I literally ate him alive after he had sat down. And he was taken aside by his senior people and said he'd better never do that again. But I saw more than pink at that point.
A really deep shade of pink?
It wasn't really one of my finest moments, but he knew where I stood with me anyway, and got done. But that was one of the things that we had to live with as being cooperators. But I don't know if that's enough explanation on it, Nancy, but I guess I just found that people believed in people, and that people working together could do more, and that people working together tried to look after each other. It wasn't, I mean, there was times that those of us in the positions of authority within the Alberta Wheat Pool, SAS Pool, or others, we had information that we could have advantaged ourselves. We knew when sales were coming on fertilizer, we knew what pricing we were going to do, but you just didn't do those things. It wasn't just the fact that legally you couldn't do those things, but morally you didn't do those kind of things. You sat on it and you dealt like your neighbors did. You knew the price was going to go up, and when you were buying fertilizer, you paid the same price as they did.
And my understanding of cooperatives is they like to make profits.
Yeah, profits isn't a four-letter word, profits is a good thing.
Like to make profits for themselves instead of profits
for other people.
For other people.
And we're right. and the other thing is that cooperators like to share that with other people that have made it happen.
Yep.
It's people working together again.
Now, anything else to say about the Canadian Grain Commission?
Well, I guess the other thing is, and the grain industry over the years had supported it to the point of financing some things, SIGI, for example, and these kinds of issues that became training grounds that the producers had no idea when we spent money on supporting an organization like Canada Grains Commission. The instructional abilities of the staff and what they could do in training potential customers or even customers that have been with us a long time of what a new variety of grain could do for them, what it would do, it paid dividends. I don't know if you could ever estimate how much it was worth to us in the long term to customer development or customer satisfaction or keeping customers. One of the things I used to find really interesting in international travel and that, you didn't deal with a lot of our customers that were prepared to pay for quality, like Japanese, for example, it's one to use. The Koreans or whatever. I mean, it took us years to sell any amount of rye to Korea. They experimented. We mailed them a sample to start with, believe it or not, in an envelope, and took us pretty near 7 years before we made any substantial sales. But they became valued customers, but this is how they work. They're not in the market and out of the market quite the same. And so we learn about our customers as well with an organization like that. So yeah, it was quite a learning process. I remember somebody asked me one day when I grew up, what was I going to do with all this knowledge that I was gaining? I said, I'm really not sure, but I sure am enjoying it. But it was an education process, Nancy, of being part of the pools in particular, but part of the grain industry from beyond the tractor seat, that you would never get in any learning institution.
If you had to pick a thing or a top three things, what did you learn about the Canadians, particularly the international component of the Canadian grain trade? What did you learn that was unlikely you would have learned if you hadn't become involved at the level that you did with the Alberta Wheat Pool?
Probably the first thing, and the easiest answer, Nancy, is the complexity of it. It looks pretty simple when you put an auger in a bin and take a truck to town and dump it in a hole, and there's something happening somewhere, they put it in a bin and it'll get loaded in a car and go somewhere. That's a simplistic overview that, as a producer, is all you need to know, as long as the check was still good and all that sort of thing. But when you look at the complexity of it, I'm amazed, for example, that it wasn't designed that way. Like, quite often, human nature, again, being what it is, we tend to make Rube Goldberg devices out of simple things. But the complexity of the Canada grain system in total is geography. It's not the fact that you can just build a better facility and faster and what we do in the country. Our geography alone creates some complexities that no one else in the world has to put up with. And we've mentioned that before. But I guess the offsets, like the adjudication ability of the Canada Grains Commission, and I'm not going to go to the Canadian Wheat Board, that was almost as a divisive debate as it was with the Crow Rate. But that organization as it existed, I learned in the international marketplace the respect it had that we did not have for it at home. Mm. It was valued and not valued because it gave them a good deal. A lot of the customers said we'd rather deal with the producer because we can buy our grain cheaper. But the Canadian Wheat Board, as an example, sold grain in 70 countries. And with the ability to sell certificate final with our Canada Grains Commission, the two working together, it paid huge dividends to producers, of which we never appreciated.
Why do you think that was? Why the lack of appreciation?
Again, Nancy, as a producer, I would never have learned that. I mean, there's so much misinformation out there. Some of it perpetrated intentionally. I think Hitler said at one time that give me a person and I can educate him when he's young, tell him enough lies and he'll believe it to be the truth. I wouldn't say that all of the information was lies or perpetrated in that sense, but the lack of a producer's ability to assess any information, I don't know quite how to term it. It's not that it was false information, it was information that was insufficient. And because of the insufficiency of the information, you couldn't make a reasoned judgment on it. And the reasoned judgments became more of innuendo and beliefs, almost like a dogma. And because of that, and because I don't have time to read every paper that's documented to try to learn the truth about something. And if my neighbor's a good farmer and he doesn't like the Canadian Wheat Board, for example, why don't you want to like the Canadian Wheat Board? Well, I'm not getting full value. And he gives me he's thought about it on the tractor, and it makes sense to me. And so I will pass that information on to the next neighbor that asks me why I'm against it, and other people that had studied it, and so then we have this division. Who's right and wrong? I don't have time to figure out who's right and wrong. I got my own opinions and carry on. So we never had the opportunity. And I guess if anything, in my experience of leaving the tractor seat and having the ability to spend a little time, and a lot of people that I worked with had good information, taught me a lot of things, and I saw it firsthand, I learned things I never would have as just staying as a producer. Unfortunately, not every producer can sit in the seat that I sat in for a while and have that ability to to get all of the things, and then I could make a reasoned judgment. Didn't mean I was always right, but at least I had an opinion that was based on some facts.
You were talking about the Canadian Wheat Board and the fact that it was quite a divisive, is that the right word? Is that
divisive
the
issue,
divisive
yes.
Issue. Mm-hmm. But on the overall scheme of things, with the day-to-day interactions of the board of Alberta Wheat Pool and the Canadian Wheat Board, what?
We had our disagreements in our boardrooms. We did not agree with everything that they did. I mean, they had a fair amount of power, and we suggested to them that we were not going to do what they would like us to do. There was reasons in the discussion. Sometimes they won, sometimes we did.
Can you think of some issues that sort of expand upon?
Not as simple.
Why people would come from it from a different perspective, assuming that you're heading for the same goal?
Yeah, I guess that part of the issue was having a buyback clause that you had to sell grain through the Canadian Wheat Board, but you could buy your barley back, or you could buy your wheat back, and then you could sell it privately, because you had to pay pool prices, which was more than you thought it was worth at that time, but you thought you could get more money if you sold it. That was one of the issues, Nancy, in particular, because they had absolute control, and there was lots of farmers that thought they could do better. Not unlike the fertilizer example that I expounded on a while ago, there was no question that there was moments in a year that farmers, if they had their truck at the border or were unloading in a U.S. elevator, could get more money than they could at home. There was farmers at that time, too, that said, I will take my $5 now rather than the $6 in 16 or 18 months when I get a final payment. That was a trend that became more evident as people started to finance and grow larger, and they needed money now. Farmers have the ability. Like, I know how to farm better than I can afford to. I have neighbors that can farm way better than I can and have the money to do it. But we have put ourselves into a financial box now where we are no longer in control of our destiny. We used to be more so. And I used to look at accounts and that, and accounts receivable were not huge. If you had a customer that had a $100,000 agro account with you, he was a pretty large farmer. Now several millions of dollars is nothing. The risk is a lot greater, both for the producer and the supplier of that. And that's being mitigated now, and this is an offside again. I watched with a great deal of interest of how agriculture finances itself now. There isn't a supplier out there today that doesn't have the backing of farm credit. If I want to have an agro account with any company, I have to have the agreement that the farm credit will pay my bills, and I owe them, not the supplier. I have had to have gone to farm credit to get my ability to $70, $100 million, whatever. But farm credit will back the supplier.
Cargill, farm credit is?
Federal. Farm credit. They used to be just in buying land and all that. Now they'll finance. Like, it used to be you dealt with the bank for an operating loan. You get operating from farm credit.
Why not the banks? Are they backing out?
Far more risk. It's not that farm credit doesn't have the ability to collect, but they look at things longer term than banks. Banks have always been difficult in financing agriculture. They talk about they're in the agricultural lending business, and they are. But they take so much security. They have absolutely no risk. And there's with the way farming is today, how do you put up rented land for security? And you're going to put $1 million of product into the ground. None of that can be used as security. But farm credit, taking a long look at it and the ability of this producer to do things, they'll lend them a couple of $1 million operating, put the crop in. and banks won't take that risk.
What, you know, you talked about the how complex the industry is, and that was one thing that, one of the complexities that came to my mind when you were talking about that was the whole financial aspect. So what was the wheat pool's interaction with the banks? Or were they operating
the,
using credit unions or both? Or
no, credit unions did not finance the pools. Not an Alberta pool anyway.
Any particular reason for that?
Our accounts are too large.
Okay.
They're huge. I mean, just to finance our daily purchasing of producer stocks across the whole of the province, we might need $80-100 million in a day. Credit union doesn't want to see that, especially a small town Vermilion credit union. I mean, our lead bank, Bank of Montreal, and then we dealt with CIBC Royal, and I mean, we had different suppliers of credit depending on whether it was a subsidiary or our daily operations. But I mean, our track record said that we were no risk, basically, and we had prime less 0.5% or 2% or whatever. You know, like we weren't a risk to the banks.
Did you have a bank of choice, or was it strictly a bidding system getting the best rate?
That's a question to ask Wally. That's a good question to ask Wally. I know that we changed lenders as lead once when I was on the board, but Wally could answer that question a lot better than me. We met regularly as a board of directors and management, senior management. We had our chief financial officer, Wally, and a couple of other people from senior management that would meet with the banks, and we'd have a lunch with them a couple of times a year, and we'd talk about the business and what we saw ahead and all that. But that was a management issue. I mean, we regularly quizzed Wally on it, and why, like, I guess when I said subsidiaries as well, when WCFL got into some financial difficulty, we actually had our lead bank drop us, and we had one of our other senior banks pick us up. It was just a change of accounts, and their books looked better, and the other fellows said, yeah, you guys will pull this out, and we did. But it was an interesting scenario. It took a while to get that negotiated as well. And we were looking at $100 million, not small change.
And I'm assuming that's also something that became apparent to you, just the kinds, the amounts of money.
Oh, it was unreal, absolutely unreal. As a farmer, dealing with $10,000, and we're dealing with $100 million,
what's a few zeros?
Yeah, just a way of keeping score. I'm going to have to get rid of that. I think you cannot come home this.
A person needs a bit of a change of scenery. I'm going to combine the next set of questions, or we'll never get finished, but I think they all fold in on each other anyway.
I'll try to be more succinct.
No. I would have sped you along if I felt I wasn't getting good information. Major challenges, changes, and significant events.
Of my tenure there?
Yeah, and it might spill over.
Okay. Major challenge when I went into the pool. Somebody asked me about 4 days after my election, and I was sitting in my office for the first time, and a news reporter said, so what are you going to make different, Mr. Livingstone? And I said, if there's anything that we can do, is that I've got to make sure that we can be flexible, because I said there's a huge amount of change coming. And I said, it's not that we're doing things wrong, but we're going to have to be flexible enough to adapt to what producers are going to do. And this was the start of when our scales weren't long enough, for example, and they were looking for faster opportunities and bigger opportunities and all this.
So what year approximately would that interview have taken place?
That would be in 84, and just starting to move. And then when I was president, that would be 87. They wanted to know what changes I was going to make in the pool, and I said, well, I'm not sure there's anything significant at this point, but flexibility again. And I said, we're going to try to meet the industry as it unfolds, because it is going to change dramatically. And we were seeing the new entrance then of Cargill and the other presence. And I could see the issues that had been ongoing for so long as a delegate, the crow rate, the Canadian Wheat Board. But I made a comment once, and a fellow reminded me of this not long ago, and he said, you know, you told me 25 years ago that the Canadian Wheat Board would be the last issue that we had to deal with. He said, I thought you were dead wrong. And he said, you were absolutely right. I said, it will not disappear quickly. But I said, the crow rate will. And it went while it was there. But anyway, that's part of it. Now, that's the significance. I guess I could see things happening, too, the way we did business personally as a producer was going to change dramatically, because I could see it on our own operation.
In what sense?
Well, the way we sold things, the way we marketed, like marketing became the watchword. We had to become marketers. When we sold cattle out of our yard, we used to have a buyer come in the yard and pull out his pack of cigarettes, and he'd do some quick figuring, and he'd buy 100 calves from us, and it was a handshake deal, and all of a sudden nobody came in our yard. And if you didn't assemble at least 40 calves of the same weight and whatever and take it to an auction yard, you didn't market cattle. And the regulations were starting to change, and how we use the tools of our trade. See that with the grain industry, chemicals that we were using. All of a sudden you had to become a licensed operator to put it on. Some of it was restricted to us, regulations of environmental issues. We had a competitor that had a 10,000-gallon liquid phosphate tank split on them, and it broke them. Just the environmental issues it created. It was handled badly, no common sense, but it was the issue of the day, and they trucked everything to Swan Hills to dispose of it when they could have spread it on a farmer's field and gave it to them and solved the issue. But common sense was not prevailing. Everything was changing at that time, Nancy. Labor relations, contractual arrangements. You had Philadelphia lawyers coming out of your ears to design the contracts right. The animosity within the industry. And I found that
animosity.
I didn't completely understand it as much as I saw it when we did the Kruger process.
What's that?
That was when we did producer cars, railway costing, safety issues, Milt Fair worked on that one too, and I forget what Milt was doing.
And what was it called?
The Kruger process, Kroeger. He was an MP at one time, and they hired him to chair the meetings. And we were supposed to bring about industry change, dealt with the railways and that. The first time I had ever experienced the animosity when the industry players were in the same room. Producers, railway, elevator associations. I dealt with them individually as such. It was thick enough to cut.
Why do you think that was? That now an industry that probably had been working pretty cooperatively, why now animosity?
The issue at that time was everybody's at the table and nobody trusted anybody. It was a question of trust more than anything, Nancy.
And why no trust, do you think?
Strategic advantages. He didn't want to reveal anything, and they were being asked to basically, don't tell me. Like, I talked too much. Couldn't get anything out of anybody that was at the table, because it was a corporate advantage. And I'm not telling you that my freight rates might be different here or there or whatever, or I'm not going to tell you that our elevation rates are not going to change this year, because that's a corporate advantage we have. And no one wanted to share the information that was necessary to resolve some of the issues that were getting thicker and harder to deal with. And when all the players are in the room, that's when the animosity was evident. Dealt with the Canadian Wheat Board one-on-one, that was not a problem. Dealt with the Canada Grain Commission one-on-one, not a problem. because it was our issue in our corporate boardroom, but don't put it out on the table in Winnipeg. And why is James Richardson want to talk about their long-term vision, sitting at a table with Brant Randall and Wally Medill and Milt Fair? You just don't talk about those things.
And the animosity didn't arise previously because the changes weren't being discussed? Or they hadn't gotten to the stage where you really had to seriously discuss them?
The world was moving at a pace where the industry found it necessary that they had to deal with this en masse. Previously, they didn't have to, Nancy. The world was moving slower, and if Alberta Wheat Pool did something, not unlike what the auto industry found themselves in a few years ago. I mean, everything worked well. GM, if it was good for GM, it was good for the world, and they were doing just fine. And all of a sudden, the financial crisis came, and Printner lost three big players because they hadn't realized the world had gone beyond it, and things had changed. And that's what happened in the grain industry. Things had changed. We had different players internationally, not corporately, but country-wise. I mean, the breadbaskets of the world were back in business. I mean, we think we're significant in the world of grain. I don't know what the numbers are today, but I remember when I was around, it was 4% of the Canada grain trade in canola affected the world. 4%. They didn't care whether we had a crop or not, and we thought we were significant. You know, Russia, you know, everybody talked about Russia being such a bad operator and they were going to starve to death and all that. When they went into the marketplace to pick up some grain, they took the Canadian entire grain trade production in a year to offset a slight deviation in their production. Like, their numbers were huge compared to us. We were not significant players, but we tended to think of ourselves as that. Well, internally, the world had gone by us, and the grain trade hadn't caught up, I don't think, with what the world was doing. And we were tearing ourselves apart, and we had to do some things collectively. Cooperatively, if I could use the term, and nobody wanted to cooperate. Just that simple.
Yeah. How necessary were the changes?
That's an interesting question, Nancy. And at my age, I guess that for the world to work as it is doing today, they had to be made. But the question could be subjective in the sense of my opinion. I mean, I'm prepared to go and run my Sea-Doo down there and spend the afternoon in a warm day.
So is this like the onset of globalization?
Basically.
Too.
Basically.
And free trade.
It's all coming together.
So all coming,
yep.
All these
the perfect
discussions.
Storm.
Okay.
Yep. The perfect storm, as you described it, and it's correct. I mean, I could say that none of it was necessary. I mean, what we've done in a lifetime here, was it necessary? Well, it worked for us, and we made a living. Would I do it differently? Probably. Dad always said that if he had $1 million when he started farming, he had made so many mistakes he'd have never recovered. So how do you know, like, it depends on your perspective on it. And I guess that as you grow older, you have a different perspective on what is essential, necessary, and I guess progress, whatever you might term progress being, was the Model T a good car? For its time, it was marvelous. But you know what the Model T developed, I use in my tractor at home, but we do it with hydraulics now rather than levers and stuff like that. So there's really not a lot of new things. Do I want to go back to a Model T? No way. So the good old days, I don't long for them. I love what we've got right now. I love technology. I can't use a lot of it because it's beyond me. I got to get my grandkids to set my timer on my video machine. However, I bought an iPhone. Reluctantly, I used to go in and I wanted just a telephone. I mean, this is an old wood elevator. It served me very well. I still got a single axle truck. I don't need a huge elevator. So is that cement elevator good? I look at it with a different perspective than the guy that goes through with a Super B. And I use this iPhone now. I used to ask for a phone without a camera on it. And the little girl that was trying to sell it to me said, "You sound just like my mother." I now use the phone and I text people, and Cheryl's got one. I mean, there's 5 iPhones in our yard, and everybody uses it for different purposes. We have internet and email and you name it. And I love the thing. GPS in our tractors, and I love the technology that's there. I don't have mechanical problems anymore. I have technical problems. And it drives me wild. Do I like it? No. Do I like using it? Yes. So that may answer the question of how the elevators and the grain industry changed. And some of it was internal, some of it was external, and all of it pushed us to what was to come. Whether it was right or wrong, I don't know. I do know that anybody that spent money in the industry beyond the farm gate, billed the farmer for it. It is that simple. The industry we have today, the farmer is still paying for. Be it freight rates, be it cost of chemicals, financing, size and scale, new tractors that we drive, all of it, the farmer was built for it. We built the original system, and we're still building the new one, and it'll always be that way.
Did farmers have to become bigger in order to pay for it? Or it was just prorated?
Depends what your desires were, Nancy. If I wanted new machinery, and I guess the best way to answer it is just like us. We used to be pretty large farmers here, 2,500 acres. Not the largest, but as big as most. We're probably now one of the smallest farmers in the area. We used to keep 300 cows. Now if you don't have 600 cows, you can't afford. Like we used to feed with a 4020 John Deere, and it cost us $8,000 for that tractor when Dad bought it. We have 2 tractors in our yard for choring right now, and they're worth $150,000 apiece. It cost me $6,000 to put tires on it. I used to get a tire put on the back of the 4020 for $300. So do I have an option? 100 cows won't pay for those tires. So I have to get bigger if I want to drive one of those tractors. Nice to run. Very convenient, warm, cool, whatever. Love running them.
Well, and as Mr. Swanson said, in many instances, even if you wanted to stay smaller, you might not get parts for the old one.
Exactly. So that 4020 is 45 years old now, and when it comes up on the screen, it's blank. They cannot find me parts for it. I have to go to a wrecker if I want to fix it, and I don't fix it. I bought a skid steer, and we're driving 3, 4, 5-year-old tractors. But it costs a lot of money. So we have to make more money. Cost me as much to put a crop in, just here, as small as we are, as Dad used to make. And I've got to make more money than that to pay the bills, pay Rob and our daughter-in-law and Cheryl and I the lifestyle that we desire to build a building like this. Although this is standalone, it does nothing to do with the farm. But yeah, we can't seat 10 people here. Serve you a meal at noon today, or you come in and have a cookie and a cup of coffee, and expect to pay for this building. We have to have 160 people sitting down, and we have to run this thing all year. Farm's no different. Elevators did the right thing. They could not stay where they were because they would have no customers, because the customers demanded more. And so it was just a wheel within a wheel, and it spun out of control. Yeah, so I don't know what size we have to be. Like, there are farmers in this area that are farming 50,000 acres. We now have One Earth Farms and a couple of them that are learning to finance, and they're taking good operators that are farming large farms and amalgamating them cooperatively using all of their equipment, and they're looking at 1 million acres putting it together.
What kind of farm?
Just taking our neighbors that farm 15,000 and the neighbor down the road here that farms 10, those two plus others that are doing the same thing, and they put all of that together. They provide the financing, the inputs, sales, marketing, all that sort of thing. And all these guys have to do it to be good operators.
So are they contracting? Become contract workers then, essentially?
If you want to look at it that way, probably. And they're guaranteed a pretty good income to do it. They have a track record. They're not putting together, but there's huge pools of money looking for homes today. There. be it teachers' funds in Ontario, mm-hmm. all those kind of things, with a return on investment. And putting it together that size and scale, they're giving a return that the marketplace won't. So that's where the money's headed, with the push of a button. So it's interesting, I'd say, that you asked that.
Any indication, like I was just checking back at when you left the presidency, and then you said you stayed on for another year, so 1990 approximately. Any indication then of what was going to happen to the pools?
No.
Did you follow it at all?
From your
perspective as Alberta Wheat
Pool? Daily. Interesting, I had my vice president at the time. I put a sign on his desk one day, a president shouldn't have vices. We got along very good. I really enjoyed Lee Schmidt. But no indication, but there was twinges within the 3 or 4 years after I'd left, that putting things together did not sit well with me. But it didn't mean it was wrong. I mean, there was speculation when I left, and I guess everybody gets this, within the industry. Like, I was young enough at that time that I could have continued for quite a while. And there were some people that suggested to me that had I stayed, things would have been different. I'm not sure about that. And I've told the people that have asked that question or made that statement, I said, you're not sure of that. I said, timing is everything. And I said, probably I left at the right time. Nobody knew how bad I really was. Didn't have a bad track record at that point. But I said, things may not have been different. I don't know. I'd have to sit at the board table and look at the numbers and the issue at that moment. And I might have made exactly the same decisions, and the industry would have changed. And I'm not sure that you can stop the so-called wheels of progress. And that could have been a disaster if I had tried to say, hey, we don't have to do that. Because I've seen companies and corporations just disappear because they refused to deal with reality. But I may have negotiated somewhat differently, and who knows, we may still have had pool one.
So the my understanding is that reason for looking at amalgamation was financial.
Yes, I guess, Nancy, when you asked that question, and there was a time, I mean, previous to me leaving, and Wally might tell you this as well, Milt Fair initiated it, and we had a meeting in Calgary Airport, and just a single blank piece of paper, and I'm not telling tales out of school anymore, suggesting that the pools needed to get together. It was a necessary thing to do. I look back on it, and we did, and I said to you, I'd rather ask for forgiveness than permission. Probably the biggest error that we made was we should have gone to our corporate lawyers and said to them, we just put the pools together, make it happen. But we went to them and asked them to put the pools together in what was necessary, and of course we had three different acts. We had a provincial act, Saskatoon was a federal act, and Manitoba was somewhat amalgamation and different in another sense. And our lawyers spent 6 months arguing about how they get these acts together. They couldn't get their act together, and so it basically fell apart. But Milt initiated a talk, and it became very evident. There's a mark on the flip chart that was this big around, and we were a button beside it. This is Cargill and their international presence, and us, with a Canadian presence in the world grain trade as it was unfolding. And Milt was quite a visionary. I guess that's why I had so much respect for him. And he saw the writing on the wall. And the other thing, egos got into it again. I mean, within our own organization, first question is, who's going to be president? Who's going to be CEO if we amalgamate? There's a couple of us have to go home. Well, we were fortunate enough at that point, and there was the timing was right in one sense. A couple of us were probably young enough to be chairman of the board. A couple of them wanted to retire. So there wasn't an issue there. We could probably have bought out our two CEOs at that time and on somebody else. And that wasn't going to be a difficulty. But was Saskapool going to be dominant? Of course, they were dominant in the grain trade. And Alberta Pool wasn't sure they wanted that. And Manitoba Pool was going to disappear. And those kind of discussions among the delegates. And so when they had a delegate meeting, it was strategically put together well. But animosity amongst our own ranks was evident. And some people enjoyed the job of being a delegate. Some people really enjoyed the fact that they were a president or whatever. Like I said, I never intended to make a career. If they'd sent me home, it wouldn't have mattered. So we had some advantages, but all of the disadvantages came forth too, and they had to be worked through. And we didn't have time to do it. Didn't get it put together.
Is there any truth to the rumor that the two did get together, right? AgriCorps and became AgriCorps, so Manitoba Pool and Alberta Wheat Pool. Saskatchewan stayed out, according to some rumors, because of an argument about where the head office would be.
There was some truth to that, I guess. It probably was one of the issues.
Yes. Well, it was an issue of Saskatchewan deciding whether Glencore could. Could be successful in its takeover bid. So,
it's all of the things you probably could name were evident and reared their ugly head.
So going back to even the animosity that you referred to earlier, so that all these major changes necessary not everybody on the same page or seeing winners and losers.
And the co-op system in particular, Nancy, is a slow system. It's a very imperfect political system. And we kind of skirted around the edge of that. Like I said, I talked with Milton, Wally, and the toughest organization to be a CEO of, because you've got 9 bosses that you have to please, where in a corporate structure, Wally and Milt would have chose their board of directors, and they would have all agreed with them, or he would have fired them. And so it was a simple structure. Cooperative structure is very complex and very slow. And that was part of the problem, too, of putting 3 pools together. Sort of like democracy, a very imperfect system, but better than most things else you can find.
Now, when the when AgriCorps was formed, you were back to farming.
Yep.
Did it make any difference to you that now there was an AgriCorps sign on an elevator as opposed to a wheat?
Yeah, okay. It tugged at the heartstrings. It was different. It wasn't. It was sort of the comment that I made to Leroy on the plane. Going public, borrow $200 million to finance what I didn't think was necessary at the time. I said, "You better thought this one through, Leroy, because that's a huge amount of money to restructure a company that's paid for." And I said, "You're asking the members to pay for it." As you restructure it, because it's got to be paid back. And when they went public, the cooperative system was different because, I mean, you've got different people at the board table and they have different interests, and most of it is economic. Not and maybe that's one of the failures of cooperatives. Sometimes they don't make a hard decision economically until it's too late. It's nice to be fair and nice to look after the guy and give the member a break because they had a tough year and all that. But it comes back to haunt you because you've got to make a very hard-nosed decision at a board table. It's difficult, and this is something that legal eagles point out to you. You can't lead with your heart. You've got to lead with your head. You've got to make smart decisions, not stupid ones. We had to leave that good atmosphere out there.
You were saying that the head, heart.
Well, you have to
conundrum.
People that are elected say my first responsibility is to the people that elected me. But your first responsibility as a director in any organization, cooperative or whatever, is to the cooperative. That's the first decision you make. and it may affect your members negatively, but you still make it with the cooperative, the entity itself. That's the first decision you got to make. And that's sometimes pretty hard to do, because you know, I mean, you got to go out and explain to the farmer that we just are not going to rebuild that elevator that burned down. You're going to have to drive 16 miles further on pavement. But guess what?
Well, I guess that holds until the decisions become too negative for the majority. Because shutting down one elevator...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the tough balance.
Because, you know, if you think that the cooperative is the people, then if it's hurting all the people, you know, is it worth...
That's when you have that, maybe the last meeting, but you have that major meeting. And you try to take people through the scenario. Either we disband and go home, or we must make this decision. There is no alternative that we can see. And sometimes they send an entire board of directors go home, and they re-elect some other people. And under new leadership, they were right. Sometimes the leadership is wrong. But it... That you have two options when you're so-called a leader. The first option you have to exercise is you can say, I am a leader, but you have to check to see if you have any followers. Because you may be ahead of the pack so far that you're all by your lonesome.
And I think cooperative is that, from what you said, that is it that kind of organization that it's based so much upon what its membership wants that you can't be out too far ahead.
No, you can't.
So
or you
education have, becomes a big part of your work.
That's exactly right. And we set up an organization within ourselves in a lot of cases, Nancy, and the pools were fortunate. I mean, we were financially strong, and we had PRs, or country service people or whatever, and we stayed in constant contact with our members in so many different ways. Our managers were well-educated. In a lot of cases, we had public meetings. The delegates had so-called canned programs that told the story as the annual meeting did it. Like, not everybody was a speaker, so they'd take a program out. The PRs helped them, and we tried to educate our members. And we tried to do it in a manner that we could get a lot of our members out. Sometimes it was a piece of pie and a coffee and a movie. But, you know, and we'd send out surveys regularly, and we'd get 20% return, which was huge in what most survey returns are. So we stayed in pretty good contact, but the education process was constant, and it was constantly changing.
Up there. I'm going to ask you about terminal elevators, because they are near and dear to Friends of Grain Elevators' hearts. Alberta Wheat Pool at one time had a terminal elevator in Thunder Bay. Did you ever see it?
No, I didn't.
When did you first see a terminal elevator, and where? The big ones.
I was a delegate, and I saw the pool elevator in Vancouver, and actually we had one in Victoria on the island, and 2 years after had begun this, about 73 or 74, and they closed it and destroyed it like it was taken down. But that was the first time I'd ever seen a terminal elevator.
So taken down when? We're trying to keep track of these things.
I would say 73, 74, maybe 75, somewhere in that time frame, because I didn't go on a terminal tour the first year, and the second year I did, and I saw Victoria, and I think they tore it down the following. So.
What were your thoughts about terminal elevators? Any eye-openers?
That's probably an understatement, Nancy. I mean, here's this naive country kid that had got off 4020 John Deere, seeing this huge industry, and never had a clue. Go on to a cleaner floor. And all these machines shaking and cleaning grain, and a belt of grain that was 48 inches wide and 2 feet deep, heading for a ship, and you know, loading in thousands of tons an hour. Mind-boggling for a country kid, and to see all this, but an eye-opener. And all of a sudden you began to get a concept that this industry was much bigger than a 6-inch grain auger and a 542 combine. You know, like it, and it intrigued me. I mean, I don't have any problem. Like I said, I can't use all of the technology that's out there. I used to own an airplane that had a lot more capabilities than I did as a pilot, but I loved it all, and I wanted to learn about it. And so I've always been that way, and I'm still that way. And I guess it kind of keeps me going and young.
So besides the size and the speed, anything else about the terminal elevators that struck you?
Just, I guess all of it was mind-boggling in size and speed, but just how it did so much that we, like, it was hard to believe that I saw the boxcars being tipped at that time, not just, and then the hopper cars were just coming in and en masse. But how everybody worked and made things happen. You know, like the guys down there on the bottom tilting a car and putting in a paddle that ran all the grain this way and it ran out and it tipped it up the other way and then it went back out, and they did it with such ease and machinery that was there, and everybody seemed to work as a team, you know, and the complexity of it was unreal. I mean, how that machinery dumped all of the grain there, and when a ship come in and began to understand that this wasn't a simple operation. You know, like they could load a ship in the rain. There were such huge volumes of grain going in there, it didn't add a 0.25% moisture to it. And the people that trimmed them, and where was it going? And what were the complexity of it? Why was that ship sitting out there? Were we paying for that and it wasn't being loaded? You know, all these questions started coming to my mind, and began to understand. And then I started reading articles about, you know, like we got an issue in Vancouver. What's the issue in Vancouver? And started to learn more.
So what were some of the terminal-related issues that you had to deal with?
Demurrage. It's been around for years, but that being one of them.
Labor issues?
It wasn't a big thing then, but it was starting. It was starting, Nancy, when I was a delegate. Labor issues were becoming more predominant when I became a director and was in the office full time. We'd have lockouts and these kinds of things. Why would we have a lockout? Well, sabotage. I mean, why would we lock out people? Well, it's amazing what happens to a grain cleaner when a crescent wrench goes through it. And how do you pay somebody that is leaning on his broom going in a small circle and doing nothing? And you might as well have him outside where he's doing absolutely nothing, and we know that everything is safe. It wasn't an issue where we dealt with, as a delegate, I'd go to an annual meeting and we were having labor issues. And we hadn't had a contract for 18 months and it was still ongoing negotiations. We didn't have a contract within 3 months. We had serious labor negotiations and what was it going to do for shipping? And it became with the railways and everything else. It became more complex as the issues went. And the issues were higher intensity, higher charge numbers. When we did a contract, for example, on labor, if we gave a 3% increase across the board, the issues of compensation on the other end of the cost of the pool was another 3%. Like we had a 6% increase to our bottom line. Those numbers were growing, and how do you keep people happy? And compared to what? I mean, our head office was in an oil town. And when you hired a chief financial officer, for example, you paid oil wages. You didn't pay grain wages. And that became an issue and created some problems within the other two Prairie pools. I'd rather work for the wages that are paid in Alberta pool. And it was only because of the town we're in. You know, like, or how do you get the talent you want? Can't afford this. The farmers are paying for this. You've got to pay several hundred thousand dollars for a good man. Can we find one in Regina that will work in Calgary? Because the wage scale was different. And all of those began to escalate. And so it goes back to your original question a while ago, Nancy, about was it possible to stay? No.
The technology changes when within the terminal elevators, were they occurring? So when they automated a lot of the systems?
Yes, that was happening throughout the whole system, right into our country things. And again, it showed how an industry is slow to adapt. We had a new elevator design in Alberta, for example, and we used the Buffalo Slope elevator. And the first three had their problems, so well, we adapted that to a different one. But the people who supplied our handling equipment, drag elevators, legs, cup elevators and all that, they had no idea the capability of our technology with their technology. And we had outgrown them. And like we built a new design elevator in Vermilion, which was one of the last things I authorized in my tenure. And it was a nightmare. We burned engines out and everything because the suppliers didn't know the capabilities of our new elevator. And we became a laughing stock for a while. And you can't afford to do those kind of things. United Grain Growers at that time actually hired our technicians to get their terminal up and running. They shut down for about 6 months and put a whole bunch of new technology in to automate. And they could not get it to work. Your computers went down and they were putting grain in the wrong bins, and like it just was a disaster. And our people went over and gave them a hand. I mean, there was a lot of cooperation in the industry. Like we had a trader, actually the head of Exxon Grain at the time, what the trade calls went sour. He was dishonest and convoluted trades and circle trades. Took the RCMP nearly 3 years to design a system that could trace the trades because he couldn't do it by it. It would take years. Cargill sent us over one of their best forensic people because they've had that problem. And they said, here you have a problem. Could you use one of our people? It was just done quietly. But, and we'd have a customer 100 miles away in somebody else's elevator, phone call to our office. We have a customer of yours in our elevator. How much does he owe at your place? That was why he was there. There was that kind of camaraderie within. Like, we sort of looked after ourselves, even though we were competitors. And so the technology, sometimes it was an issue, but there was help within the industry to find it. But yeah, none of the changes were made easy nor cheaply. And there was some wrecks.
Exxon Grain, what made me think of that as you're talking about trading? Mm-hmm. Any comments on?
It was a good organization. It was a good organization for the pools. We had a couple of very, very good senior chief executive officers that ran it. Originally, it was the right thing for the pools to do. It gave us an ability to trade. We put some restrictions on ourselves. As I said, we decided we'd only deal with Canadian grain. We probably could have become much more of an international player if we hadn't just tried to sell our own grain and dealt with an international grain trade. We dealt with them, but we sourced Canadian grain. And it was restrictive because our competitors could do some things that we didn't. Not that we couldn't, that we didn't.
Were you allowed to work with Canadian Wheat Board? Because they would have established connections, so they were sort of the big...
We had
hate to use the term big brother, but from the standpoint of the senior...
It wasn't an essential element for Exxon to work. But we could work with Canadian Wheat Board with no problem. I mean, we did as organizations and as a subsidiary for the three pools, it wasn't a problem. But they basically traded non-board grains, canola mainly, peas. Interesting though, you got into you needed different acumen of the people that we had. Trading with other countries, for example, we had three shiploads of peas. It took us a few years to get the money back on. And it was based on, like, if you want to have trade issues and you can, without any of the so-called regulations protecting you, you talk about health issues, like there was contamination in these peas. Well, there wasn't. Canada Grains Commission could prove that. We had documentation and certificate final and all this. But you got to go through the international courts to prove you're right. And we proved we were right, and we got paid. But it took a while. Now, this is where farmers get into trouble, and they say, well, I can do what Exxon Grain does. I can ship to Pendleton flour mills. And once it crosses the border, you're in a whole bunch of new rules, and they decide not to send you a check. What do? You don't. But as an organization, we could. And I've said that to farmers on occasion. I said, because I've watched farmers in the cattle trade. They'll ship 40 or 50 purebred cattle across, and they never saw cent. You try to deal with that internationally, very different than if it was an Alberta-Saskatchewan trade. And you're in a whole different arena when you play in that league. So Exxon Grain was very successful. Exxon Grain was a very respected organization. We had a fellow in Exxon Far East, which was located in Tokyo, Japan, Eddie Yumamoto. Absolutely a superb trader. First time I'd ever sat at a board table and looked at a number on the financial. I said, this number here, and I, one of my first meetings, I said, there's a typo there? No. Everybody grinning around the table wondered if I'd see this. $1 million membership in a golf club. I said, what? How do I go home and tell my farmers that we have $1 million membership in Mount Fuji in Japan? That's where our business was done. We had $1 million golf membership. And there was a waiting list if we wanted to sell it. And we could have made money on it. But I mean, here's this naive farmer from the country seeing $1 million golf membership. And I'm going to talk to farmers about it. I didn't talk to farmers about it. But I mean, that was one of the cute memories.
Do you remember how to spell his name?
Eddie,
when it comes back to doing the transcript.
Eddie is Yumamoto, Y-U-M-O-M-O-T-O, I think. Wally will know.
Yumamoto.
Yeah,
okay.
Yumamoto.
Yeah.
Super guy, and knew the Asian industry. Like, he could sell refrigerators to Eskimos and stuff like that. Like, he was just, and really, really astute. Very sharp. Speak English well, and could speak any other language necessary to make a trade. I remember walking around in downtown Tokyo at 2 o'clock in the morning with Eddie. One of my junkets. But it was interesting to see the industry internationally too, Nancy. We had one of the most modern crushing plants in Alberta, Alberta Food Products, and I was vice chair of that. I spent a lot of time in subsidiaries as well. And we had 80 people. We ran at 3 shifts. We could do 600 or 800 ton a day. I think we got it up to pretty near 1,000. I think we made one year profit out of 6, trying to struggle in an industry that didn't understand itself here in Alberta. We had government competitors with a plant in Peace River country. But beyond that, go over to Japan and go into Mitsubishi, 4 people crushing 1,200 ton a day, going into an 80-foot high brick building with 2 automated robots, shipping and receiving, in the dark, in the cold, and a little brick building over there with about 5 people running computers, and just going constantly. We had no idea about efficiency. And they were customers of ours. They must have chuckled every time you were to see 80 people trying to keep a plant at half the capacity they did with 4. I mean, those are the kind of other things that I saw. Or going to Russia and see a huge industry that had no infrastructure to handle anything and couldn't deliver. Just the complete opposite. So, yeah, anyway, another aside.
Did Canadian, because you visited Russia, and I just came back from Russia, and took a picture of a terminal elevator there, and wondered who built that. Do you know whether any Canadian companies were involved in building Russian terminal elevators?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know, Nancy. I know that Alberta Pool had some technology, and we built with the technology. We didn't build them in Brazil, and we built a couple of countries and a terminal elevator.
Did you have your own engineers then?
Yes. We had our own building department, if I can use that term, and they built concrete and tin and basically looked after the whole country system and Vancouver Terminal. Yep.
What happened to Alberta Pool Elevators Archives, do you know?
I don't know. The person that would was probably would be Dale Riddell.
Okay.
He's in Winnipeg.
Yes, I've interviewed him.
Okay.
Nice man.
Yep.
Did they have a newspaper magazine that went out to
yep.
members?
Driveway Breeze.
Driveway Breeze.
Mm-hmm.
So there's probably copies of it floating around, and had a good collection of photographs and things in sort of a library.
Yeah, and it's a good question you ask, Nancy, and I've wondered about it. I'm not like there was a lot of things we had, some pretty fine paintings too, in the corporate boardroom. I don't know what happened with them. We still have one of them in the Grain Museum, in Calgary. That's at the Stampede Grounds. And that is struggling now to find funding to keep it open, but that was a neat place.
We're competing with them.
Oh.
I'm going to ask you a general question then, and I think you've probably answered it, but it, just in case you want to add something else to it. You said early on that it's quite remarkable, given just the distance that Canadian farmers have to deliver their product in order to be even a player on the international playing field. So what do you think are all of the ingredients, major ingredients, of Canada being a major international grain trader? What essential ingredients are there that we can do what we do as well as we do?
I guess, Nancy, I could term it a couple of things, and I've thought about this before, and it's interesting you ask a question like that. The buffalo industry, you say, now where is this going? The buffalo industry had a unique product, and they decided that they could make it like beef, and they were going to bring buffalo in off the grass, and they would feed them grain, and they would have a better product. And it's a good product, but it's not much different than beef. And they had a unique product, and they forgot about that, and they could have been head and shoulders above a lot of places. It took them a while to get back, and they're starting to maybe understand that. I think the grain industry in Canada has to make a decision, and if they make the wrong one, it may be difficult to survive, I think. And this is where we may go broke. And I'm not suggesting that I'm right on this, but I remember a couple of speeches I made, and I still have copies of them. And I often wondered if anybody read them, because I predicted some of this stuff 20 years ago. Anyway, if we decide that we're going to be a Walmart, we will not survive, because we have competitors that can do it much cheaper than us. If we decide that we can do something unique as Canadian players in the grain industry, and we do it well, we will survive and thrive. It's just that simple. I'm not sure that we're not trying to become Walmarts. Now, with the consolidation of the industry, some of the major players in there, I think, may keep our uniqueness. I think Richardson's, for example, understand that. They understand the grain trade well. Cargill will use Canadian commodities if it suits a market. But they work in volume, and they work on slim margins. And the volume and slim margins make a lot of money. And if we're just volume players in Walmarts, they will use Canada as long as it's necessary, but they will pick up from wherever. But I think the uniqueness of our Canadian system, our climate, our ability to segregate and IP, we have that capability, and I guess that was one of the other things that really bothered me with our inland terminals. I could see IP coming, because being a secret, identity preserved, and you don't preserve very much identity of anything if you're going to make a homogenous solution out of a bunch of cars of grain, trucks of grain that come in, and a 90-foot silo that holds 10, 15, 20, 30,000 bushels of grain. Where the old country elevator with a 5,000 bushel bin could segregate that grain and keep it unique, because it was unique. It was a high protein, number one, whatever grain, and we could keep it as an identity and ship it as that. And that's why I say if we become a Walmart and just work on volume and that, the companies and the players in it will work well, but it will not be in the producer's interest, because we can do some things on our farms, big or small, that are unique. And if we can keep that as a Canadian product that's unique, we can get a premium for it.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, I watched some of the big farmers move, for example, to high-yielding wheats, and they're just basically ethanol producers. And they say, well, if we get 70 bushels at $4, we don't have to wait, you know, the Canadian Wheat Board was a part of the problem at that time, we'd have to wait for the premiums and all that to come in a pool, and we'll take the money now and run. I think that we can have designer grains, but our system that we built won't handle them. And we're going to see people like the short line railway operators that have got $1.5 million bins, 3,000 bushel capacity. They'll meet that market. They'll be able to segregate their own grain. Cooperatively, they'll do it as producers, and they'll get premiums for it. And they'll bypass a system that has a huge cost. And that's where I say sometimes some of these players have got to either deal with that, or they won't get paid and they'll go woke. But we're gonna, and I sometimes think there's a master plan somewhere. The 10 and 15 and 20,000 acre farms, they can't afford to be unique, because they get paid well to be bulk producers. And so the system is being designed to keep the system that we've designed externally from the farms, keep it going. Look at the players. I'll give you the financing and all of the products. And even marketing expertise. Cargill will do that. He'll do that with a feedlot. And if you're a beginning young farmer and you can't get financing from your bank, why wouldn't you go that way? But that little guy that's got 2,500 acres like us and can produce an 80-acre field of specialty grains, and somebody can preserve it for us, if it's my cooperative neighbor down here that's got this track shipping system, there's room for that player. So it'll be interesting to watch it change, Nancy.
Interesting you say interesting, because someone once said, maybe it was Bob Rowley said, the only thing that the players can agree on now is that it will be interesting times. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it will be successful or not is. In the long term, the fact that the major farmer run and owned operations no longer exist, pools being one and the wheat board being the other, that's also interesting, but up in the air, the fact that those no longer exist.
Sad. it's interesting. I guess the question I ask myself, Nancy, and I've heard other farmers say, do you think there will ever be another, will we redesign it? And I said, well, I don't know. I said there has to be an awful strong commitment. I said the issues that were there at the start of the pools development are bigger now. Huge amounts of financing necessary to start up a company. I've watched farmers try it, and they call them new gen co-ops, and they take an elevator and they all finance it and upgrade it and it works. It's just a cooperative way of, and a different way of financing. It's not a co-op in the sense, if you put in $100,000 and I put in $10,000, my neighbor gets to use it 10 times as much as I do, that's not a co-op. You know, like, it's in name only, and it's a new way to finance. But yeah, there's always been interesting times. It's just how it will unfold. And I've reached an age where I'm still extremely interested in it. I I would love to be part of it. But like I explained to somebody, they wanted me to go to some meetings and become so-called important within the organization. I said, I have now become part of the problem rather than the solution. And I'm a spectator. And not unlike a ball player, when the coach is looking for that absolutely superb ball player, they're out there. If he could just get the hot dog laid down and the soda pop and out of the stands, he would be a super ball player because he has all the answers. I'm a spectator.
Yeah. you'd mentioned the grain facility at the Calgary Stampede, mm-hmm. and Dale Riddell and I had talked about it.
Right.
I think the letter that we sent you introduced what we were hoping to do as Friends of Grain Elevators, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the voices being a tangent from that. That we have put in an application for National Historic Site status for at one point it was a Saskatchewan Wheat Pool yeah. elevator, but it was actually a privately owned elevator okay. when it was first built 100 years ago. So we've got that going to the National Historic Sites and Monuments Board. But ideally what we would like to have is an interpretive center. Representing the national nature mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. and the export trade.
Right.
Our focus is on, yep. because of where we are, on
yep,
the export
exactly.
trade.
Yep.
So what are the chances of our success? I will not put a number on it, but it's not zero or I wouldn't
no.
be working on it. What do you think should be featured in that? And focus on the sort of grain shipping, grain handling, grain exporting aspect of it that would adequately represent Alberta Wheat Pool. What would you like future generations to know about what happened and it continued to happen for 80 years, I guess?
Hard question, Nancy. A lot harder than anything you've asked today. I don't know. I watched the change in the food industry. I mean, we're part of it here, a different aspect. I'm not sure anybody cares anymore. It's unfortunate because, like I said, if you don't learn from history, you are doomed to repeat it. I'm not sure that we understand as consumers, of which I am one. I have a little better understanding of the production of food than most, but only because I play in it. Most people that eat food really don't care, unless the biggest thing is it cost effective? Does it interfere with my budget for all of the other things that I want out of life? And I don't care where it comes from. I mean, the fact that we have food issues. And I've argued this in the industry as we went through 7 years of BSE here. I don't think we learned anything from that at all. Politically, we probably still couldn't shut down an area. I think we would shut down our whole country if it had foot and mouth and everything. And I mean, we should have learned enough of how to segregate and contain. We learned nothing from that. The fact that we had killer spinach. Actually, three people died, they can prove it, of coming across the border, and it was not a border issue. And nobody has ever died from BSE out of North American cattle that they can prove, and it took 7 years to resolve it. Shows that it's still a very live political issue. The fact that we can get melamine and milk and products and that from China, and it doesn't become more of an issue than a blurb in the paper a little bit. The consumer doesn't quit buying because the price is right. Health issues, and the niece that was out here is an exercise nut and a health nut, and she's good at what she's doing. Most people don't care. Most of our health issues are self-induced. I mean, I got a son that smokes, a daughter-in-law that smokes. They know the dangers, and they won't quit. I've never smoked, and it doesn't mean that that's why I've lived this long. It's because I'm, like my neighbor said one day, he said, I'm never going to die because he said, God thinks I'll take over, God doesn't want me, and the devil thinks I'll take over. So, you never know. But
It's interesting that you say, does anybody care about that history?
I would hope so, Nancy, but I wonder. It's a good question. What should they learn? I don't know what people... Put it on an iPhone and maybe we can teach more people.
Yeah. One thing I'm thinking about, I'll just run it past you, is... and it relates back to our discussion about will cooperatives be missed? And some people have said about the Canadian Wheat Board that yes, it was a good thing in its time, but it is no longer necessary in order for successful Canadian export grain trade. Mm-hmm. So would the prairies have looked any different if the pools hadn't existed? Or was it, again, was Alberta Wheat Pool and its sister brother organizations a necessary element for success, or just a different element for success, given a small country? I mean, you can just compare it, say, to the States, and the States, you know, they built up a successful farming operation, but with far more people.
I could give you a facetious answer. They say that the success of a rain dance is timing. I don't know, Nancy. That's another good question. There's no simple answer to that. I mean, look at the dynasties throughout history that have come and gone. Rome basically ruled the world and disappeared. Britain ruled the seas. It is insignificant. The American economy is in disarray. And whether it'll survive for a long time, I don't know. People still invest in the American dollar. But it could be a dynasty that's on its way out. So there was a time for the pools. There was a time for my tenure with the pools. Would I have done things differently if I'd stayed? I don't know. If I went in there now, would I be effective? Probably not, because it's changed. I was there at the right time. John F. Kennedy got assassinated, and the world carried on. And he was a super good leader, I think. History may not prove that to be true. There's all kinds of different stories now. But so would it have been different? I don't know.
So
would we have gone to where we are now if the pools hadn't existed? Did the pools, like I said initially, we were there to change status quo. And throughout the history of three generations, we became status quo. Maybe our time was up.
Did the pools prevent, as the railways did, north-south economic ties leading to... being able to keep a Canadian country? Because my understanding, one of the reasons that the money was spent to build the railways,
keep the Americans at bay and to develop the West.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you're
right. And would railways have been enough? Or were pools, would the American companies have come in because they were the big players then? Who knows, eh?
Yeah.
I hate to think that they had no use.
Oh, no, they played a role. I've asked myself that question, Nancy, personally. When we moved, never left the farm before, never thought about it, found out there's life after farming. I mean, Cheryl and I could have agreed that we could both move again if we had to, or wanted to, but we don't. What would have happened to our family if we hadn't gone to Calgary? Our daughter married a person from, they met in university, mind you, but in Alberta, in Edmonton. Our son took a course in SAIT and became a chef, worked in Earls and stuff like that. What would have happened if we'd have stayed home? Would they married a couple of local boys and girls and all farmers, or would they have, like, what impact did our move have on the life of our kids or our own? I mean, the contacts I've made, the travel I've done, my perspective because of some of the things I've seen, would it have been different? Would I have influenced other people? I've asked the same kind of a question, personally. And I don't have an answer for that either. Not much different than did the pool have an effect? Obviously it did. It served its purpose for those that designed and built it. It served a purpose for the second generation that used it and basically took it to the heights that that all of them attained. And whether or not it just idled, and like I said, it probably became status quo, and we lost it because the third generation using it. Farms do the same, and it's sort of 80% of the 10% of the 20% of the producers produce 80% of the production. It's almost the norm. I think it's true in most cases of farms, generations, and who builds, who uses, who loses. Not true in every case. Hopefully not in ours, because I either that or stayed too long. But that's a question that's always going to. I guess 100 years from now, we may be able to answer that question better than we can right now, because the pools have disappeared, and not that long ago. I mean, in history, it's just a second or two. But did they have an influence? Did we design, were we models for other organizations, new gen co-ops or whatever? Did it make communities work better? Did we learn? I spent a little time in the last while, and I don't go to them anymore. I did go back to Ottawa a couple of years ago. We were talking about designing a program, and I happened to be fortunate enough to go through a program called AgriLeader here in this province. It was a 3-year program, financed by the cooperatives and RIDA, Rural Education and Development, and the province. And it cost them a lot of money at that time, 28 or 9 years ago. And I looked at Alberta agriculture and industry. We were in oil sands development. And 15 of us participated in it. And the northern people learned about southern Alberta, and we all learned about our province. Then we went into Ottawa, and we learned about Canadian government and how it works. And then we went international and looked at 6 countries in Europe during the economic community development for 21 days. It was a very good program. I, again, learned a lot, both from the peer group I traveled with and also what we saw. And it was very well designed and good program. So I look at what we, there's a great deal of discussion now on leadership, and we've got to develop agricultural leadership, and there's a couple of reasons. Most of the big farmers today have no time to go to a meeting. They become cynical because the meetings they go to are non-productive, and they're basically become messengers to take home a message rather than listen to their ideas. And it's a waste of time. So how do you get agricultural leaders to come forward? Well, companies are providing it, be it agronomists or whatever, and they become more forefront and they're leaders in their own fields. But they don't have a broad perspective that some of this leadership program gives them. And I said to the people in Ottawa, are you prepared to finance it? Well, they were looking at it, but what would it cost? And I said, fund 4-H. I said, 4-H is a program that I watch, and I saw it with great interest when I used to sit at a desk and people would come looking for a job, and sometimes they'd stop in my office. Could I give them a recommendation? And I said, I don't have to. I said, you are 4-H, aren't you? How did I know? He said, it sticks out all over you. You can public speak, you can think on your feet, you have a presence, you're obviously a good person because you're competitive, you're keen, all of this stuff. I said, they do that with a 2-hour meeting for 10 months, for probably 5 years of a kid's life, and they develop leaders. I said, there is no program in a school and nothing you can finance that will do better than 4-H. I said, fund it. You'll have all the leaders you need. Well, they didn't know it was 4-H. Yeah, it's a good program, but we want to develop leaders. I said, just pick the people that have the potential. This program will develop them. And I'm shooting in the wind at that point. But, we're always looking for the magic bullet and the whatever it would be. Eureka, we've got it.
Yeah. It's not instead that if it's here, but it's underfunded.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you very much. I've taken up a good deal of your afternoon and a nice afternoon. I apologize for that, but I'm really pleased that you made yourself available. And,
thank you, Nancy. I appreciate it. I appreciate the interest. I mean, nice to think that I have an opinion that might count somewhere. 100 years from now,
somebody 100 years from now, when you're listening to us, some obscure master's or doctoral thesis that you're doing, appreciate that we took this time.